KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Washington.
In Kolkata, India's red light district, the New Light Foundation runs two centers for people who are caught up in the sex trade, children, boys and girls, and women. They get health care, meals, tutoring, in the case of some children, a roof over their head. We're going to talk to the founder of that foundation. That's coming up a little later this hour. On Weekday, I'm Steve Scheer. Thanks for joining us. We'll also talk about the endangered birds of the world, how many there are, what's being done to protect them. But this hour, we start with Jerry Kornfield, reporter and columnist covering Olympia for the Everett Herald. He's been giving us a blow-by-blow of the session in Olympia for the legislature. And Jerry, it looks like a special session is, what, 2 weeks away, are you saying?
Right. Last night, Governor Jay Inslee said May 13th, 9 a.m., is when the lawmakers are all due back in Olympia. However, he's got a few folks that he wants to be showing up starting early this week and meeting every day, and those are the ones that in the House and Senate who are involved in negotiating on the operating budget, because that's always the big piece that needs to be resolved first, and then all the little pieces seem to come together like a puzzle.
Now, you had some tough words for Jay Inslee, the governor. Thus far, more skilled at communicating in cliche and metaphor than securing success for his priorities. He's had a huge learning curve, as you say, and he sort of has kept the session a little bit at arm's length. What does he have to do to prove himself to you, Jerry Kornfield? What does he have to do?
Well, he doesn't have to do anything to prove to me. I was just trying to, looking at him, and I think any governor in their first term coming from Congress, especially where things are done a lot differently over a much longer period of time, right? They go a whole year and they might not get anything done in the state legislature has 105 days, and by the Constitution of the state, they've got to get stuff done, and they haven't yet. I think he has shown that he's going to be very active in the special session. I mean, by waiting 2 weeks, it did anger some Republicans, but his response is, I want to get these guys in the room and do some heavy lifting beforehand, so when all the lawmakers do come back, they'll have something to talk about and start voting on. So in that regard, I think he's made a public stance that I want to be involved to a much greater degree. So that's step one. But I think he may have also undermined that commitment in the sense that he didn't take anything off the table going into special session. And what we've become a little bit conditioned to is when they don't get things done in regular session, they come around and they just start making it a shorter list of things to do. And this is a year where probably need to focus on a couple of budgets, transportation and education, and some of the other issues, as important as they are to himself and to his political base. He may want to pass on those, but he hasn't yet.
Yeah, I think I read a quote from one state senator who said the scope of the special session is stunning. Everything is on the table, including things outside of budget considerations.
Right. And, I mean, the budget, I want to be clear here. When you talk about the operating budget, it can cover a wide range of issues all by itself. And, for example, a battle that's been fought for a while here, the House passed a bill called the DREAM Act, allowing undocumented immigrants who are bound for college to be eligible for financial aid from the state. They are not eligible today. Now, the Senate has refused to take up that issue, but the House adopted a budget and they put some money in it saying, yeah, we're passing our budget and we want to make these folks eligible. So they wrote it into their budget, which means it's still alive and it can be discussed. And so that's how some of these issues that maybe peripheral issues become part of the discussion. But he's opened the door to a whole bunch of items that will probably consume time. And as I wrote in a story today, they were stymied for 105 days on most of these issues. And by not reducing the list at all, he's asking them to do it in 30 days to settle all their disputes that they just couldn't do in 105.
Well, the other thing you wrote about, the Senate Majority Coalition, is proving they can stick together 23 Republicans, 2 Democrats, proving they could stay together. But did they get any of their priorities moved forward?
Well, I think on education reform, they have. I mean, they have not, you know, they can't hold up 10 pieces of legislation and saying, here is our reform agenda, and we completed it. But what I think they've accomplished is a couple bills have been passed and signed by the governor. More importantly, there are still some big issues to be discussed, and the governor wants to talk about them. I mean, he's calling these, you know, he's saying education reform is necessary. So on that front, I think they've really pushed forward. Their biggest test now is, A, can they stay together on their sort of no new taxes pledge, or are they going to now reshape their message and come across as a little more compromising and accept some new revenue from taxes, and then and finding the ones that they can embrace in some way, shape, or form, and then that can be done. Because it does not appear on paper that these two sides are that far apart once the coalition accepts a couple of those tax measures.
What is the status of some of those tax measures from your assessment that seem most likely to make it through the legislative session?
Well, we should start at I kind of break them into sort of two areas. The first area is what the House passed right off, you know, early, maybe like 3 weeks ago is early, but they did that, and it deals with some changes in the telecommunications and landline phones and taxes that have been in, and some fees that have been in existence. The industry wants some changes. If those are made, that'll raise more than $100 million for the biennium, and they've been pressuring the Republicans in the Senate to agree to it. And some of them are willing, but they haven't gone on record publicly. So that one may go forward. There was an estate tax change. Supreme Court took the law that the state had on the books for years, tossed it out, and said, you know, you need to make some changes in it. They've made those changes. If they can enact those, they'll make another $150 million. That's a battle they can probably relent on, I would think. After that, you're looking at one here, one there, that might add up to another $150 million. I mean, there's ones a lot of folks don't even talk about. There's a tax on the reselling of prescription drugs at a lower rate by out-of-state companies. These are sort of like generics, but they're being sold by companies from out-of-state, so the in-state companies don't get that tax break. If they, even the playing field, there's $30 million, and I imagine the coalition can look at one of a tax preference like that and say, you know what, we can argue that's evening the playing field, so we'll go with it. And suddenly, a couple more of those, and they're done.
What about what just won't fly? What's your assessment?
Oh, the beer tax.
That's gone, right? The beer tax is gone.
Yeah, I mean, the House Democrats passed a beer tax that was about half the size of what the governor proposed. So already they didn't ask for as much money. And then they applied it to the very popular microbrewing industry in the state. So that didn't go over. And then the big macro breweries, the Anheuser-Busch's and the Miller Brewing folks, they whispered in the ears of the Democrats and said, look, you know, we're pretty big, and we do make a lot of money, and we don't mind spending $1 million or $2 million to challenge your tax measure right on the ballot. So, and I think that, the whispering was heard, and they said it's not worth it, so we'll give that one up. So that's gone, and that's not going to come back. The one they fight over a lot is whether folks like from Oregon and other states without a sales tax, whether they should be able to come to Washington and not pay a sales tax. That's been talked about. That's going to be a close one. I don't know, bottled water. I don't think they'll put that tax on bottled water. They can make a good argument for it, but it just, some people just haven't paid it for years, and they'll find that to be pretty offensive, and the bottled water industry might step in too again. So those, I think, don't pass.
So then where do the House Democrats stand? Because that's Frank Chop's purview, and he has been a pretty strong advocate for some of these new taxes and new revenues, especially for state public schools. What's their opening discussion when they go into special session?
Well, since they did trim very small bit of their tax revenue off, they've shown that they're willing to roll back how much they bring in. And I think they'll go to the table and say, here's a few other items we'll drop. They won't be on day one because they don't want to concede too quickly, but I think they further sort of scale back their tax plan, maybe by $200 or $300 million, just to show a willingness. And I think part of the problem between these two budgets of the House and Senate is that the House Democrats and the governor look at the Senate budget, and they have a lot of questions of where the money comes from, that there's some assumptions in the Senate budget that add up to so much money. They're kind of looking at the Senate saying, really? Can you need to, we need to see how seriously accurate those assumptions of money are going to be. And if they can get the Senate to agree to change some of their, if you will, assumptions, that might bring the two sides closer together. But I think the House Democrats are first going to just scale back what they want in revenue as a first step.
So then where does that leave the new money for education? Is there enough common ground that we'll see close to $1 billion in new money for education this session?
I mean, I think it will get close to $1 billion in for education, in part because two of the biggest pieces deal with paying for school bus transportation and the materials and supplies. And, you know, everybody wants to put in $500, $600, maybe even $700 million into those two areas alone. And that's a really big amount of money, because what it does then is the local school districts, who are paying out of their own pocket for some of those materials, will now be able to take that money and shift it into the classroom or to other things. And so school districts will probably be happy to see that money. And I think the $1 billion will get there. You know, you do a little tweak here, a little tweak there, and over the course of the next 2 years, you can say that they put in $1 billion. Even if, you know, maybe it's $400 million the first year and $600 million the second year, they will get to $1 billion.
So does that mean with the they have some watered down in terms of the supporters, reforms for evaluating high schools? They're not going to get grades, but there will be there are these proposals for taking those schools under the wing, offering them help, state funding support. Is that where the governor endorses this sort of medium steps towards school accountability? Does he use that to go back to the Senate leaders and say, look, I got you this far, let's get some money on the table now?
Yes. I mean, I think that's one of his opening lines in the negotiating. I think he will, you know, and he may move a little closer to some of their positions. I mean, we may actually end up with something on the books that grade schools with A, B, C, D, E, and F. I mean, we have a grading system now. It has words, and so they could convert the words to grades. So he may even go that far to help move that along. Workers' compensation is an issue people don't want to talk about much, but there may be some changes in there that he could agree to, and those affect sort of long-term savings, but is another victory for the coalition. So I think those are two areas that he can move in. I think he would do well to consider not pushing. He continues to push for wanting a background check law for private gun sales. Well, there was an organization this morning announcing they're going to go after that at the ballot next year. So he might want to give that item up and call that a concession, because that's going to be handled on another political front. So he's got a couple areas he can move.
And they have passed a transportation budget?
Well, they passed the budget, but the budget is essentially, I don't want to get into the weeds too far, but it's what they like to call bare bones. It essentially, everything they've been doing in the current budget, they're just going to keep doing. They don't have any new money. It's the same amount of money coming in, so they can only do the same amount of work. So they can only do so many potholes. They can't do any new projects. They got to keep paying for things like the Alaskan Way Viaduct replacement. I mean, that's in the budget. So what they really need is what they say they really need is a separate proposal, another gas tax hike, to start doing anything new, like completely finishing the new 520, the floating bridge, or widening I-405, and big projects that are out there to be done. They're going to have to get more money for that, and that's what they'll talk about in special session.
All right, sir, you get a shave, shower, change your clothes, go home, and then you'll be back to cover it again.
Yeah, but I tell you, the first day of special session may not even be, we may forget about that when nothing's going to happen unless, we'll be all watching the Sonics decision.
Oh, man. There's another one. Yes, we will. All right, Jerry, it's good talking to you.
Good talking to you. Take care.
Thank you very much. Jerry Kornfield is a reporter and columnist covering Olympia for the Everett Herald. He's been keeping us up to date on what's been happening in that session throughout the session and the upcoming special session as well. Stay with us. This is Weekday.
#9:19, breaking the cycle of human trafficking. We'll learn about some work that's being done in Kolkata, India, in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Tiny's Organic Farm, providing a variety of fresh organic fruits and vegetables, now introducing the Paleo Box for adherence to the Paleolithic lifestyle approach to eating. Local delivery available from Zarly.com. More information at Zarly, Zarly.com/Tiny's Organic.
49 degrees in Seattle, mostly cloudy. We've had showers this morning, and there's a good chance of showers the rest of the day with a predicted high of 54. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:20. The beauty of endangered birds in 20 minutes.
In Kolkata, India's red light district, the New Light Foundation runs centers to provide people caught up in the sex trade with health care, meals, tutoring, some cases a roof over their head. New Light is been working in the area since it was founded by Ermi Basu. She joins us in our studios. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Would you say a little bit about yourself? You were a person who had parents who were working in social service in a sense. They were parents who were committed to the ideas of being involved in society. You went to school and you decided this was your path as well?
I was born to parents who were professionals and also socially very committed. My father was a doctor and my mother a healthcare professional. And by the time I was 16, I knew that I would do things that would at least make an attempt to change the things that are not really correct in my society.
How come? I mean, you didn't have to, right? That was just your calling?
Yes. I felt responsible for having received the kind of opportunities and the education that I did. And of course, at 16, it was not that clear that I would follow, which in retrospect I can say, yes, probably I had that first idea when I was leaving school.
You know, I read in your biography that you worked as a relief worker during the Bhopal gas leak in India in 1984. How old were you then?
20-something.
So what was that experience? How did that experience shape your views?
I had just joined our School of Social Work, that's the Tata Institute of Social Sciences, and we got information about the disaster. We were immediately taken out there, and we had to do a lot of relief work, attending to the people. It was an unbelievable experience.
Many people died in that.
Many
horrific ways.
Yes, it was a horrific experience. And it not only that many people died, but the aftermath of it continued for so many years, and people not really getting adequate attention and compensation. That was very frustrating for many of us who had volunteered as young people at that time.
Who did you blame? The company? The government?
Everybody should be held collectively responsible for it. You just can't point your finger at somebody and say, why were not the checks in place? How did the licensing work? And why weren't there enough emergency relief set up? Which is pretty much the case even today. I mean, if there is that kind of a disaster, industrial disaster, I don't know how well prepared India is today.
That's a little unnerving. I guess we're finding out that many systems are not well crafted. That's what we saw in the Gulf as well when
That's
the oil
true.
Exploded there. How did you come to start working in Kolkata? How did you come to start working with women and children who were involved in the sex trade?
When I was getting my master's in social work, I had the opportunity of working in a special cell for women in distress under the Commissioner of Police in Mumbai. And during that time, I went to Kamathipura, which is another very, you know, notorious red light district in Mumbai. And I saw these young girls behind barred windows. Those days, they were called the cage girls of Bombay. The situation definitely has changed a lot since then.
For the better?
Yes, definitely for the better. And but that is in no way to say that the number of girls trafficked into the trade has gone down. But the general, you know, the look of the place or the way the girls live today, certainly slightly better than what it used to be those days. And that was, again, a very, very deeply impacting experience of mine. And I decided that if I were ever, you know, competent enough or had enough resources, I would like to do something for these girls.
Well, what was there some, did you speak to some young women in particular as you first encountered them?
Yes. But the communication was not very, what should I say, open, because they were all constantly watched, and outsiders were not really allowed to interact with them freely.
How would you then interact with them?
Only, you know, in passing, if some of the girls were standing on the street, how are you? How long have you been here for? But they would say one or two things and then look away, because they knew that they were being constantly watched.
Why was that the turning point for you? What was it about their plight that most seized you?
You know, of all the disenfranchised people everywhere in the world, I felt for a woman who has to sell her body for survival is the worst situation. It just so completely dehumanizing, and it felt that they were really at the bottom of the ladder.
Where did you see their children? Because that's part of who you're dealing with here, their children as well. Where were they? Were they in the rooms with them? Were they somewhere else?
My first visit to Kalighat was in the year 2000. And when I arrived there, I saw many young kids running about in the streets. I also saw some of the children sleeping under the beds of their mothers, while the mother would be actually on top with the client. And I felt this is not something that any child anywhere should go through. I mean, this is unbelievable. I was stunned. I was horrified. And I just came away and couldn't stop thinking about it.
So what were your first steps, Urmi Basu? What were your first steps in getting them at least out of those rooms?
I kept on going back there, made friends with some of the young boys who were in their late teens, and I proposed to them about setting up a creche, a night shelter. I don't think they really took me very seriously, because I'm sure before me there were other people who had made similar offers. And then they said, okay, fine, you have to give us something in writing. How long are you going to be here for? What are you going to do?
These are the young boys
yes.
who lived in the area?
Yeah, exactly.
So they were empowered.
Yeah, sure. And I said, I'm not going to do any such thing, because if you can do nothing, even if I give you reams and reams of things in writing, and if my intentions are correct, things will work even if I don't give you anything in writing. So there was kind of, mutual testing out of each other's convictions and commitment, and we began the work. The next step, of course, was to have a series of meetings with the mothers. And I offered them the creche care, which is something that was not available. The first idea was to get the kids off the streets and off from the sight of the pimps and the customers, and to give them a safe place where they could be in the care of other adults from their own community. So we engaged some of the ex-prostitutes in looking after the kids. It worked out very well for both sets of people.
If you have read Half the Sky by Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudunn, or seen the PBS documentary Half the Sky, where Urmi Basu's New Light Foundation is featured, and I think we see a Hollywood star, right?
America Ferrera.
America Ferrera is there. We see those young people that you work with. We see the rooms that you work with. They are nice, clean, but small and Spartan, those rooms that you have arranged for them. How do you pay for that?
We raise money constantly, and we've been lucky in having many people who've contributed individually. Some foundations have supported us. It began, New Light began, with the support of Shadika Foundation, a Palo Alto-based foundation 12 years ago. We are deeply grateful for their support. They still continue to support New Light's work, and we have groups here in Seattle that support us. One of them is Village Volunteers. We have the Presbyterian Church of Mercer Island, who's invited me here today, and also Rabbi Jay Rosenbaum from Herzl Ner Tamid, meeting their congregation.
You are still a small NGO.
We are definitely a very small NGO.
What's your operating budget? What do you? It says you serve 1,000 women and children each year. So, what's your operating budget?
Last year it was $250,000.
That's a small NGO, right?
It is.
how many, when you're serving 1,000, and you in just in Kolkata's India, in Kolkata's red light district, how many are you not serving? Do you have a sense of that? I mean, are you just getting a small percentage?
Very, very small percentage of people is who we can reach out to. In Kolkata, they say there are about 90,000 to a lakh of women who are in prostitution.
90,000?
Yes.
And how many children as well? Is there a number for that?
If we do a general calculation, it would at least be another lakh of children.
Wow. You have done this for more than a decade, so you have seen some of those children grow up?
Absolutely.
Go to school? So that's what keeps you going? You see a few successes?
Many, actually. Some of our students have already finished high school, university degree. One is in a catering college. One's a computer animation, graphic animation artist. There are 7 girls who are in the university. One has just finished her master's degree in social work. One is studying physics at the post-university level. And there
really?
Are many, many.
That's nice.
He wants to be an astronomer. So maybe one day we will see him at the Bhabha Atomic Research Center.
That would
Who
be
knows?
Great.
That will be.
And some of the women, some of the mothers, have they been able to leave the trade?
Many of the mothers have left this trade, and they have their small enterprise through our microcredit facility. Many of them are working with us on the project as peer educators for HIV and AIDS care program. Some of them work as our staff members. They take a huge ownership of the project as well. They're very, very involved.
Where do you get the health care? Who provides health care?
We have doctors that we pay for at our clinic, and we collect medicines by way of donation from various doctors, and some of our donors buy medicines for us. But for the rest, we definitely have to send the patients to the government hospitals.
So did you say are you paying for those doctors to come in?
Yes.
That's part of your foundation work?
Absolutely.
And those doctors are coming from India? Or are they volunteers from other parts of the world?
Doctors and nurses cannot really practice active medicine in India without accreditation from the Indian Medical Association. So our doctors are local doctors, but doctors and nurses are encouraged to come out as volunteers to do other kind of work in the clinic. Like just having them sit in there or to do a consultation for a critical case is invaluable.
So what's your long-term goal for New Light?
We would like
reasonable long-term goal. Because I saw when you were considering that, I thought, I think, to get everybody out of poverty. But I saw that flash across your face. But
if we could have all the 200 kids that are enrolled into our education program today, have all of them graduate from first maybe high school and then university and have jobs that would give them a dignity and recognition to live independently, that would be a big thing achieved. Second is to provide people with basic sanitation and health care. We also plan to set up our boys' home, which is Kalaghar. That's very, very essential. We are constantly talking only about the girls being in an abusive situation and ignore the boys. But if you don't pay attention to them and their lives right now, they are the ones who'd be future pimps and procurers, and they would get engaged in trafficking. So this is a very, very important preemptive step. And then our hospital, which is a care center for HIV and AIDS, affected people. We plan to do that as well. It's a big plan.
I want to ask you a few more broad questions. So, for example, selected as the NGO co-coordinator by the Office of the Governor of West Bengal to make a presentation on microcredit, women's participation in gender sensitivity and health issues when Bill Clinton came in 2001. What happened out of that effort? Did you get more support from the government, from the West Bengal government?
President Clinton did not really come to talk about support. He was there more to understand the level of work that was going on. He met up with 12 NGO representatives. And it was for us a great opportunity to present our work to him. And then subsequently, each of the NGOs went on doing their own work. I'm not aware if anybody has received any big grant from America India Foundation. But it's a recognition, and it's also a great opportunity to share.
You also worked with when former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton when she came to India. You talked about experience of working against trafficking in persons. That was an issue that she was familiar with, that she worked on. Anything come out of that?
Oh, we are doing a lot of work on that. And Secretary Clinton's visit to Kolkata was an extraordinary show of support for our cause of saving girls and women from trafficking. And the government has really become far more proactive. Recently, we've had some fast court rulings that have not only convicted the people and have talked about compensation and exemplary punishment, so that the traffickers would think, yes, things are getting tougher for them to operate on. And it was for us. She said she was our best cheerleader. What better could we hear than that?
You also had some impact from participating in and being featured in Half the Sky. What was that? What was the impact of that, both the book and the documentary that was made? And then, of course, there were follow-up events, right? Global Citizen Award. You got this Global Citizen Award at the Global Music Festival in Central Park. I mean, what kind of follow-up came from being a participant in those events?
Half the Sky, I think, has changed the very profile of all the organizations that were featured in that documentary and the book, because it's a huge endorsement, it's a huge recognition. Many millions of people have come to know about our work. And it is not that we cannot always quantify the impact by counting the balance in our bank accounts. It's more to do with creating awareness. And I think that is exactly what Nicholas and Cheryl wanted to do by writing that book and by following it up with the documentary. It's been invaluable.
Do you see the awareness in India? You said that lives for the women have changed somewhat. How has the awareness changed in those alleys, on those streets in India?
Half the Sky hasn't been shown in India yet. They don't have the distribution rights. So it'll take a couple of years, but few people who have seen it, clips of it online or have read the book, many young people are wanting to get engaged in this issue. And then the police officers, the law keepers, and some of the government officials, they're also getting more aware of what could be done.
And what about more broadly? What impact have you seen from your work a decade later? You say you've seen the changes for the individuals you worked in, but do you see a change in tone or temperament among the sex workers, among the pimps, among the people who are trafficking?
Some of the women who were in prostitution 10 years ago are telling us, giving us more, creating more voice about, oh, this has to stop, because they see their girls having opportunities and they have seen the possibility. But we work only in a limited area. I can't really comment on what's happening in Mumbai or in Delhi or in Hyderabad, Bangalore, Goa. We do have exchange of ideas with our colleagues in the field. But it's been there for so long that it's going to take a considerable period of time to say have any perceptible sense of change on a larger scale.
Urmi Basu's visit to Seattle is from the 27th of April through May 5th. She'll speak on breaking the cycle of human trafficking. She'll speak at a community-wide event on Mercer Island on May 5th as well. And they'll screen the New Light segment from Half the Sky. We have links to some of that work at KUOW.org or at our Facebook page, Weekday on KUOW. Urmi Basu, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Urmi Basu is a founder and director of New Light Foundation.
The Beauty of Endangered Birds, in a minute, on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Group Health Cooperative. 65 years ago, Group Health integrated health care and health care coverage with one goal, better health for everyone. Information at ghc.org/one goal.
49 degrees in Seattle. Today's predicted high is 54. The forecast calls for clouds and showers. Overnight, a low of 39, clouds and showers. And tomorrow, Tuesday, partly sunny with a high of 57. And then looks like lots of sun starting Wednesday.
Join KUOW for a live broadcast of Garrison Keillor's A Prairie Home Companion on Saturday, June 15th at Chateau San Michel Winery in Woodinville. Learn more and find ticket information on the events page at KUOW.org.
It's 9:40. I'm Bernard Ouellette, recreating the sound of the Big Bang in 25 minutes.
590 bird species are endangered or critically endangered. Some only live in captivity. Around the world, there are places where only old nests and the memories of their songs remain. Photographer Tim Lehman and ornithologist Ed Scholes have been working on a Bird of Paradise project for the National Geographic. Extreme, bizarre, extraordinary. They're talking about these issues at as part of the National Geographic Live talk. And they join us in our studios. Thank you for being here, sir.
Thank you.
And sir.
Yeah, thank you.
It's good to be here. Tim and Ed. Well, you asked me why I had this book, The World's Rarest Birds. But I was reading The World's Rarest Birds because I was curious about that number of the endangered or critically endangered birds. And so I picked up this book to look at it because the there are so many darn birds on this planet. What is it, 10,000 species of birds? Is that
roughly
right?
That's a good number.
Goals?
Yep.
Has anybody seen them all?
I don't think so.
I mean, you know, you read about those people doing the big year, Tim Lehman, and trying to, you know, see a number of them. They don't get anywhere near that.
Yeah,
10,000.
There's some pretty dedicated people out there who are getting pretty close. You know, the leader is it changes from time to time, but I don't know that anybody's gotten, you know, quite that close yet. I don't know what the current world leader in birder is. But.
All right. Well, you guys took up the idea of trying to see as many of the birds of paradise as you can. Is that right?
Yes. It didn't actually start as an idea just to try to see them. It was one of my sort of dream assignments for National Geographic to go to New Guinea and spend a lot of time photographing a story about them, which I got approved back in 2003. And hooked up with Ed, and who was doing research on these birds of paradise. And then we started working on an article for National Geographic magazine. And the first article was actually published back in 2007 after we did 3 years of field work. And then it kind of grew into this bigger project to try to document all the 39 birds of paradise for the first time.
Why were they interesting? What's so interesting about these guys?
Well, birds of paradise are really fantastically diverse and unlike most other birds that people have seen. I mean, as you can kind of guess from their name. But the males are incredibly colorful, have a range of feathers and courtship display behaviors that surpasses any other group of birds and is as diverse as you find across all of the avian world. So to have this group of incredibly beautiful and interesting species in this one little part of the world around New Guinea just really had a lot of appeal.
Why is New Guinea such a hot spot, if you will?
Yeah, well, I mean,
For bird life.
For birds, yeah.
And more generally in diversity.
Yeah, so it's a tremendously rich in a lot of biodiversity. But for birds in particular, it's sort of a combination of historical and geographical fate. So this part of the world, Australia, New Guinea, is part of the ancient continent of Gondwanaland. And anyway, this is where passerine diversity. This is like the cradle of passerine diversity. So all these perching birds that we know all around the world really had their origin in that part of the world. So it goes way back in the roots of avian diversity there. But then on top of that, as people probably are familiar with in Australia, you don't have the same mammal fauna that we find in a lot of the rest of the world. These are the marsupial mammals. So we don't have the same predators that you encounter for birds around other parts of the world. There aren't cats, for instance, that are predating on birds. So that's one reason why the birds of paradise have evolved to be so extravagant, or civets or other things like that you find in Asia. But also at the same time, there aren't mammalian predators for fruit. And so a lot of tree species have evolved to provide fruit specifically for birds to be the primary means of dispersal.
How'd you end up there, by the way? How'd you decide to be studying the behavior and evolution of birds of paradise in New Guinea? Columbia or Cornell?
Cornell, yeah. So it started when I was a graduate student. I did my PhD research on birds of paradise, and I had kind of been interested in this kind of breeding system that birds of paradise have, where you have this tremendous skew in certain males who basically mate with almost all the females. The females are choosing which males are the most attractive, and they're very strong consensus in their choice, and that leads to this really interesting evolutionary outcome. And I was interested in that type of process, and I had spent some time in Australia, where there's another group called the Bowerbirds, and I had done some undergraduate field research on that group, and so I wanted to get back. And when I learned about the birds of paradise, I kind of just said, hey, that's it. If I can do anything with my research career, I want to try to find a way to go to New Guinea and study birds of paradise.
And so how did you decide, Tim Lehman, that was going to be? Like that? Why was that something that was compelling you to be taking pictures of birds of paradise? You do a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of critters.
I do a lot of different wildlife for the Geographic. I actually got out to Indonesia a very long time ago, back in 87, we're in the western part of Indonesia to go do research in the rainforest in Borneo. So there are no birds of paradise there. But I read this book by Alfred Russel Wallace, a contemporary of Darwin, the sort of, you know, guy who came up with the theory of natural selection independently of Darwin while he was out there on this eight-year kind of sojourn around the archipelago, you know, studying and collecting specimens of natural history. And he wrote this, you know, this famous kind of narrative of his travels called The Malay Archipelago, Land of the Orangutan and the Bird of Paradise. And I went out there to go to Borneo, and where I was actually, you know, seeing orangutans and studying rainforest wildlife there. But, of course, I read about Wallace's descriptions of the birds of paradise, and he was the first Western naturalist to actually see them displaying in the wild and described, you know, in vivid detail how they used, you know, males are gathering in these treetops and, you know, showing off these flamboyant plumes and, you know, attracting the females. And so, of course, I was intrigued by that. I was curious to see them, and I had a chance to, you know, travel on a bird-watching trip over to the eastern part of Indonesia way back in around 1990 and saw a few species. And so then I was, you know, intrigued to see more. And I think what it was, you know, I realized that, you know, nobody'd really – given them a full photographic treatment. So the National Geographic had done an article on birds of paradise back in the 50s using paintings. And I felt like, you know, the Attenborough and his BBC teams have done some, you know, made some good efforts on filming a number of species, which have been prominent in, you know, Planet Earth and other films like that. People may have seen those. So, but kind of following in their footsteps, you know, nobody had sort of gone out to try to do a really comprehensive still photography treatment of them. And so I got the National Geographic magazine interested in that, and they supported my efforts to go and work on that project.
All these pictures are from the wild?
They're all from the wild, yep.
Your just patience and long lenses got you these photographs.
Yeah, patience, long lenses, and, you know, working with somebody like Ed who can locate a display site by, you know, homing in on the male's calling. The key thing with birds of paradise, you're never going to, like, walk around the rainforest with a big camera and sort of get a picture of one. You have to find, you know, where are they going to repeatedly? You know, where are they going to show up at again? You got to do some advanced scouting, find their display site. These males, you know, if it's the right season of the year, they will, you know, sort of choose a display position, and they'll come there repeatedly. And so basically the two approaches are to either, you know, find a display site and try to wait for them there, build a blind, hide, and wait for them to come back. Or find like a fruiting tree. You know, for some of the species where we couldn't find a display, we would We would see where they were feeding, and, you know, birds are a bit of creatures of habit. If they find a good food source, they'll come back repeatedly. So, you know, I also did that, stake out their fruiting trees where they were coming and wait for them there. So
you asked me why I had this book again, The World's Rarest Birds, because I was wondering how they are doing, birds.
That's a really good point. Actually, there you won't find too many of the birds of paradise in the
They're
world's rarest
this,
birds
yeah.
because actually New Guinea still has a very intact rainforest relative to other parts of the world. I mean, there's the large in the whole Asia Pacific region. New Guinea has by far the most intact forest left, and three of the birds of paradise are listed as sort of vulnerable on the IUCN list. None of them have reached the so-called endangered status, and then many others are sort of getting near threatened. Right now, you know, they're still in relatively good shape. So that's sort of, you know, we're a bit ahead of the curve in conservation, but there's a lot of increasing threats in New Guinea right now. It's really ramping up with timber running out in places like Borneo and Sumatra. Logging companies are like heading to New Guinea. And also there's increased, you know, oil palm plantations going in and all this kind of thing. So although birds of paradise have survived well up until now, they're going to be under increasing pressure in coming years as mainly from habitat loss.
Cats, mongoose, rats, critters like insects, those are still low predation in New Guinea?
Yeah. I mean, so there are natural predators for birds of paradise, things like lizards and snakes and some small mammals. But there, of course, have been introduced animals that have come with people, including some primates, which naturally occur in New Guinea. No monkeys there, but they have been brought over with people who have moved there from other parts of Indonesia that have them, and they have escaped into the forest there. So there are some threats of things like that as well. But so far, it's been pretty limited, and no clear evidence yet that it's having an impact on birds of paradise specifically. But
we're talking about birds of paradise. Photographer Tim Lehman and ornithologist at Scholes have done an extensive survey, 39 birds of paradise species captured on film. You know, talk about it. National Geographic shows some pictures. I will point to a bird. You'll tell me what it is and how you got that picture and describe a little bit of it. And then Ed Scholes can tell me how you did that. So how about, what is that one?
That's the Wilson's bird of paradise. It's a very strikingly colored bird. It has like a bare skin on its head that's bright blue and then yellow patch on its back, bright red on the wings and back. And this bird is only found on two islands off the western tip of New Guinea. We had to go to these islands. We had to climb up a mountain. They're not found on the coast. They're found a bit up inland, up in the mountains. We had to hike in. We found their display court where they display on the ground by listening to the males calling, and then build a blind near the court, hid there from, you know, before dawn every morning for a week, and waited for this male to come down to clean his court, to sit there and call and wait for females.
Why do they do that? Why do these guys operate in this elaborate and organized fashion?
Because that's what many thousands of generations of female Wilson's birds of paradise past have found attractive in their mates. That's the short answer. So basically,
you're going to give me the answer for each one.
Right? That's the answer for all of them. That's right. So the appearances and behaviors of male birds of paradise are all the physical manifestations of the preferences for mates in female birds of paradise. And that is the short answer. Of course, there's a lot of details that vary among them, and we don't know the most of those details. Yeah, we haven't been able to do those studies.
Yeah. All right, so how about this guy?
That one is the king bird of paradise. It's a bright red bird with a white belly and has two extraordinary tail feathers that have bright green discs at the end. And this bird doesn't ever come down near the ground. It lives up in the canopy, and it has it's actually one of the smallest birds of paradise. It's really hard to get close enough to for pictures. It likes to hang out in a big vine-covered tree that it uses as its display area.
How'd you do it?
Well, I after we located a number of these birds in an area called the Bird's Head Peninsula of New Guinea, which is the sort of western part of the Big Island of New Guinea, I had to climb a tree. So I used a bow and arrow to shoot a line, a fishing line over a branch as high in the tree. Pulled up my climbing rope. You know, we used ascenders to climb up the rope. Constructed a platform up in the canopy by tying in some poles, making a floor with some boards and then camouflaging myself up there. And then I spent, you know, many days going up there and using the sort of biggest lens I had to 600 millimeter with teleconverters added to try to get close shots of that bird.
Wow. Where's that bird live? Way up in the canopy. So what does it eat? What is it?
Almost all the birds of paradise are fruit eaters. That's one of the important, you know, factors in their success in New Guinea and part of their evolutionary story as well. There's a lot of fruit available for birds, and that's sort of freed the males to be able to – there's an abundance of fruit to allow them to spend all this time displaying to females. Males don't take any role in parental care, so all they do is basically display and pass on their genes. And it also makes it easier for the females to also spend time watching males, and they don't provision their young on fruit alone. They eat more insects when they're feeding their chicks. But
I see. Just like people. Mm-hmm. How about this one, especially the insect bird?
That one is called the Magnificent Bird of Paradise. You notice they all have these very colorful names.
Well, one has to outdo the next.
Yeah, exactly. The Magnificent Bird of Paradise displays on a also on a court near the ground where he displays on a little vertical sapling that is his perch. And he's got this bright green breast shield that when a female comes nearby, he leans back and he presents that breast shield to her. And it's made of iridescent green feathers. So you have to get the angle right to see that bright green color. So he aims that right toward the female, try to lure her down.
So you alluded to this. I was alluding to it. New Guinea, is it going to be able to withstand the forces of development? Any better than Borneo did, for example?
It's hard to really know. I mean, it has withstood it this long because it's a really out of the way remote place that's incredibly geographically and geologically complex, and so there are very few roads throughout New Guinea, and it's difficult to build roads. But you know, all it takes is people with the right amount of money and motivation to do it, and we're on that cusp right now. More and more exploration and development for its natural resources.
How about the people that live there? The people that live in and have grown up in New Guinea. Those people are, I mean, that you had pictures. I saw pictures that you had taken on your website. Are those people, you know, are they part of the exploitive part? Are there enough indigenous voices to push back? What do you think?
Well, I mean, New Guinea is unique, especially almost all of this rugged, inaccessible land is considered to be owned by somebody. So even if it's a distant mountain range that no one ever goes there, there's somebody in a nearby forest who will point to that land and say, that's my land. And so there are people all throughout it. And in Papua New Guinea, those traditional landowner rights of the indigenous people are honored by the Constitution. And so in some ways that makes it easier for conservation and harder for development. But then at the same time, development can come in a negative way and basically buy its way in because those people can grant permission without having to go through all the governmental channels. Hmm. But right now there aren't a lot of the governments aren't functional enough to basically protect their natural resources successfully. But, you know, people there aren't – most people live as subsistence agricultural farmers. They don't have education. They don't have health care. And, you know, just like everybody in the world, those are things that are important to them. So the real trick is finding a way to improve the quality of life of the people that live there while at the same time maintaining these natural resources for their benefit as well as for, you know, everybody else who lives on the planet, including things like birds of paradise.
You record videos.
Yeah.
That's part of what you do.
It is.
You recording the sound of these creatures as well?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you have a library of 39 distinct calls to go with the 39 distinct species?
We do. We don't have all of the sounds as comprehensively documented as as photographs and video, or a lot of the sounds have been recorded in the video. And they, you know, there is a tremendous amount of hidden vocal diversity in the group that hasn't been appreciated because they're so, you know, visually appealing. That's been a focus even for our own work. So that's one of these good areas of continued and further investigation for us, is to do more research and more documentation of the vocal diversity of Birds of Paradise.
Birds of Paradise Revealed, that book out? That book's out, right?
Yes, it is.
It says fall 2002, so it's... I mean, 2012.
Yes, it came out end of October.
Yeah.
Yep.
So it's out. It's happening.
It's out. Yep.
People can see all the pictures there, and they can see pictures in the latest National Geographic. And they can show up and hear you guys talk tonight.
That's right. Or you can go, we have a Bird of Paradise Project website, birdsofparadiseproject.org. You can hear some of those audio recordings that we were just talking about of the diversity of most of the different genera of Birds of Paradise, and lots of additional video that we recorded for throughout the duration of the project.
Ed Scholes and Tim Lehman tonight and tomorrow night at Benaroya Hall as part of National Geographic Live, displaying their photographs of Birds of Paradise. Thank you both.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
And now, the sound of the day.
Listener Lori and her husband were walking along the perimeter trail at Blake Island. Their friends Robin and Mike, their two Boston Terriers, Tank and Hugo. And Mike and Tank ran ahead. Hugo, who was in Robin's arms, started to let out this chortle in an attempt to call them back.
So that's not an evil monkey?
No, that's a Boston Terrier. Wow. So what are you hearing? That sounds like you'd hear that in New Guinea, doesn't it? Not on Blake Island in Washington State. Send us a sound. Record 30 seconds of it. Send it the sound of the day in the subject line. Stick around. More stories about birds and other creatures coming up.
It's 10 o'clock. The Supreme Court has blocked Alabama from enforcing a state law that authorized the police to arrest and jail people for hiding and transporting undocumented immigrants. We'll have more about that in the...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.